live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And I'm Tim Lloyd.
And from St. Louis Public Radio,
this is We Live Here.
Hi, guys. It's like, you would bring a reporter and a microphone into my office. This is sacred space. I should have knocked.
This is where we take the vital signs for patients, and I'll show you our operations department.
Okay, great.
On the show today, we take you behind that door, where an entire system is working to provide healthcare.
And our tour guide is one very busy
our
doctor.
Front desk location.
Do you ever slow down? I have to ask you.
Not in this building.
Yeah.
And like most doctors, she doesn't have time to see us right away.
So here we are, in the waiting room at the Grove location of Family Care Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center.
With us in the waiting room are Black, white, Asian, and Bosnian patients.
There are families, mothers trying to prevent little ones with the wiggles from getting out of hand.
Yeah, some people here have private insurance, others Medicaid or Medicare, or no insurance at all.
Our appointment is with Dr. Heidi Miller. She's a very busy primary care physician we mentioned earlier. And while we're waiting, let's get some basic information about this place and federally qualified health centers out of the way.
I mean, first of all, what is a federally qualified health center?
Funny you should ask that question.
Oh, it's our show researcher, Tom McClure. Hey, Tom.
How's it going?
Good.
Tom has all the answers.
Yeah, so let's start there. What's a federally qualified health center?
So it's a community health center that receives federal grant money to treat uninsured patients, although insured patients can also come as well. And the family care health centers received about 30% of their revenue from federal grants in 2014.
And okay. So family care health centers, we're at the one in the Grove right now, mm-hmm. in the waiting room still, but you said center, so there's another one?
Yes, there's a second location in Carondelet.
All right, so who's going to the centers?
So there are actually four different networks. Family Care Health Center is one of those four in St. Louis City and County. And altogether, those four networks served about 130,000 patients in 2013. In 2014, the Family Care Health Center specifically served about 20,000 patients. Around 50% of those patients were white, around 30% were African American, and about 12% of the patients were best served in a language other than English.
So as you stated when you gave us your wonderful definition of what a federally qualified health center is, they accept patients who don't have insurance. So how many of their patients are coming without insurance?
In 2014, it was about 34%.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
And we're going to take a quick little break while we wait to see the doctor.
All right, so Dr. Miller can see us now. And the first question we want to ask her is what kind of patients she sees.
In a typical day, in order to keep the roof over our heads, a provider like myself needs to see about 24 patients. But I'm not seeing the same thing over and over again. I'll go into one room and do a steroid knee injection for an old man who's trying to work, but that one arthritic knee is keeping him from working. And then I'll go into the next room and I'll have a patient with a really, really unusual rash. I am taking care of an incredible diversity of patients that are real people working really hard who have real diseases.
And one of those patients is Kendra. She was kind enough to let us eavesdrop in on her visit with Dr. Miller.
Kendra works at a skilled nursing facility and has young children at home. She has diabetes and is having trouble sleeping.
How have you been feeling?
A little tired. Well, now I'm tired, but I've been okay. Got my work schedule changed where I'm off more days.
Good.
But I work longer days when I'm there so that I can be off more.
But that's the schedule that you want. Gives you the flexibility that you want. So when you say longer hours, how many hours?
16.
Oh.
Yeah.
Most normal people would consider that two work days in one.
It is. I just work three back to back.
16, 16, 16? Okay.
Actually, it was 8, 16, 16, 16.
So we don't need a sleep study to understand why you're tired today.
Yes. So that's why my daughter didn't go to daycare. I'm like, I can't get up. And I'm like,
let's see what Tim wants.
My patients work incredibly hard. I see my patients struggling to earn a living, and not only can a health problem interfere with their ability to earn, but The thing that strikes me that I've witnessed hundreds and hundreds of times is how physically demanding my patients' jobs are. In addition, they need the healthcare to keep working. And most of my patients want to keep working. I have a patient who washes cars for a living, and he broke his ankle. That's devastating. No insurance. It's very humbling for me that he has completely lost his income with one broken ankle, which took months to heal. When I had a minor foot injury, I continued to see patients. I just wheeled in one of those little chairs from room to room. I continued to see patients. And even if I couldn't, I have sick leave. Sick leave is the greatest luxury. I had no idea.
That kind of insecurity, where literally one misstep can derail you or your family's life, can contribute to something called toxic stress.
Toxic stress, very simply, is when unintentional or intentional negative events occur over and over again, more than one. For many people, it starts in childhood. And it continues on.
That's Bethany Johnson-Javoy, and she's one busy lady.
I'm the managing director of the Ferguson Commission. I'm the CEO of the St. Louis Integrated Health Network, and I'm in evangelism and ministry when I'm not doing those two things.
So we touched on toxic stress a little during our last show and told you it can literally change the way a child's brain develops. It can create problems with impulse control and learning, and that can lead to unhealthy habits in adulthood.
And when people get older, living with toxic stress can actually speed up the aging process. Ailments like arthritis and asthma can become more severe.
Anyone can be exposed to toxic stress, but people living in poverty are especially vulnerable.
Bethany Johnson-Javoy can give a bunch of examples.
I need to get to work, but I have to get to this appointment at the same time and pick up my child. How am I supposed to do that? Or toxic stress within municipal courts. I have tickets. I need to go get it fixed. I don't have the money to get it fixed. My kid can't even come in with me as I sit. I'm stressed, and you want me to be my best self and to perform.
And there can be other contributing factors, not the least of which is how safe someone feels in their own home.
Dr. Miller says treating environmental factors that can land a patient in her office over and over again wasn't necessarily something she picked up in med school.
So I spent 7 years in medical training, and I was taught what normal physiology is. I was taught what pathology is. So what's normal and what happens when the normal body goes bad? I was given a new vocabulary to name all those abnormal diagnoses. So basically 7 years of learning how to identify a nail that I can then hammer. Nail, hammer, nail, hammer. Problem, solution, problem, solution. Over 12 years of maturing as a physician, I have realized that human suffering does not come down to one medical problem with a pill that solves it. The vast majority of my patients are in some capacity suffering from stress in their lives now or in their past.
Let's eavesdrop on another appointment.
Coming, coming. Thank you, Ricky. Okay, so.
But it's like a switch.
Dr. Miller and nurse Lexi Munter are sitting down with Brenda. Brenda has multiple health issues, and her home life is stressful enough that she's leaving town to stay with her sister in Mississippi.
Making a decision to like exit a stressful environment and go to a more supportive one is probably the most important health step that you can take, okay? Because, you know, every day you can try to micromanage stress, but as long as you're just drowning in it, it's really, really hard to get a hold of it.
So thinking about their community and their immediate concerns, bills to pay, jobs to secure, that those issues, they trump the med list.
I am happy for you if this is a happy transition.
Yeah, my sister them is down there, so okay. They helping me out a lot.
Okay. One thing that I mentioned to when Lexi and I, we were really trying to take good care of you together, and I want to make sure that we have your health in tip-top shape before you go to Mississippi.
Okay.
I want to make sure we have a list of medical issues that are current and what we've done to address them. I want to make sure that your medication list is perfect, that there's a reason for every medicine that you're on, and that you are not on anything that you don't need.
I can only prescribe so much medicine. And at a certain point, if a person has environmental challenges, community challenges, financial challenges, legal challenges, there's no pill for that. And in fact, if I overprescribe, I'm providing a disservice to our patients.
And certainly if we can get your pain under control now, then when you meet a new doctor in Mississippi, you can just say, here's the list of medical issues, here are the medications that have been working, and then they can just take that and run with it, okay? The other thing that I want you to do now, you're gonna move to Mississippi in about 2 months?
Yeah.
Okay, now I want you to make an appointment with a new primary care doctor there.
Okay,
don't wait until you're there.
As dynamic and skilled as Dr. Miller is, she can't cure poverty. But to treat the ailments that often come with it, the center's model is to put as many resources as possible under a single roof.
Family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, gynecology, obstetrics, dentistry, optometry, pharmacology, nutrition services, the list goes on and on. We have a psychiatrist here with behavioral health staff. We have WIC here. Everything under one roof. It enables us to take care of the entire family.
And she envisions one day being able to write a prescription to go see a lawyer who works with the clinic and can push a landlord to clean up mold that can aggravate asthma.
Oftentimes, patients' legal problems are the biggest barrier to their health. And so utilizing legal services for our patients would be an ideal partnership.
But she can't prescribe a better job, safe neighborhoods, or better schools for kids. All things that make many of the health issues she sees in low-income patients that much more acute.
I don't know about you, but I just get this sense that we're about to come full circle.
I mean, yeah, back to Jason Prunell, who we had a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Prunell is the Washington University researcher who's been studying all the health issues that go hand in hand with segregation and poverty.
And in particular, I'm thinking about when you asked him to tell a story about how racial and economic segregation influence, say, how long someone lives.
So if health is, you know, shaped by all these other factors, education, economics, where you live, can you tell us essentially a story of how these might interact and impact health?
It starts really before you're born, the quality of prenatal care that your mother receives, the amount of stress, the educational level of your mother is impacting children before they're born. And then early impacts of things like early childhood education, the quality of neighborhoods that children grow up in, the availability of resources like fresh fruits and vegetables, safe places to play. All of this impacts health. Then you go on into education and the quality of your education. Education is one of the strongest and most consistent predictors of later health outcomes that we have. The quality of education, but also the quantity of education, the number of years of education that are completed, tracks very closely, correlates closely with people's health outcomes. For instance, people who have less than high school education far more likely to smoke than people with incrementally higher levels of education. And we know smoking kills over 400,000 people a year. Back to the notion of behavior driving a lot of chronic disease and premature mortality.
You're talking about navigating these complicated systems. And I wonder, in a region that is so deeply segregated, if you'll talk a little bit about how racial segregation might play into ability to navigate those systems.
Racial segregation hampers one's ability to access resources that are distributed through networks. And we talk a whole lot about things like affirmative action and policies that sort of mandate that people have equitable access to certain resources. But at a more informal level, we know that all sorts of resources are doled out through social networks. The old adage is that it's who you know and not what you know. Mm-hmm. And there's truth to that. much of it is not malicious. The social science research and social psychology will tell you that people distribute resources within their social networks because of their relationships to other people and their similarity to other people in a very natural way that isn't intended to exclude other people. What's pernicious about segregation in St. Louis is that we've had a set of policies going back several decades that keep people separated. And that separation isolates certain populations from the resources that are being distributed in both formal and informal ways through networks.
But often people are excluded from information on healthcare, especially in a segregated city like St. Louis.
And like the human body, there are systems on top of systems.
Right. And what Brunel is saying is that you can't start talking about treating chronic conditions without dealing with inequities in things like housing or education.
I mean, fair enough, but that doesn't change the fact that there's all those people in the waiting room where we started this show who need care today.
You know, during our interview with Bethany Johnson-Javoy, she brought up an interesting point that dovetails with what Prunell was saying about networks and people.
We've got some generational, institutional stuff that we've got to dig in and build relationship with patients, with individuals, with people again, and restore that trust, because healing does not happen till trust is restored.
She says regaining that trust isn't something you need a bunch of medical training to figure out.
Basically, it's about making sure people feel comfortable and are welcome in a doctor's office, or that they know how to get care in the first place.
And she gave us an example of how this can play out in the real world, one that hits very close to home for her.
You know, we're going to be spending a lot of time with Dr. Heidi Miller. Can you tell me just a little bit about her?
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm going for days. So Dr. Miller is a Harvard-trained physician who doesn't slap Harvard on how she practices. It's interesting. So people in some circles, because of her degree and pedigree, that gives her some legitimacy. But with her patients, what gives her legitimacy is her empathetic way of interacting. So Dr. Miller actually sees my father.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She sees my father. And so this is easy for me to talk about. And he has chronic multiple issues going on. Heidi is not Dr. Heidi Miller in that room. Heidi, oh. Sorry.
It's okay, take your time.
Heidi comes into the room and she looks at my mother's face and she can see that my mother does not trust systems. So she doesn't start with her typical question. She asked my mother for her perspective on how my father is doing. And when my mother shares her thoughts, she honors her perspective. She doesn't open up her laptop to go down the med list yet. She peeks out the door as my dad is walking in to see how he's walking, because that's an indicator of how he's feeling. She takes individual pill bottles and she marks them with black markers, so that it's clear for an 80-year-old who needs bigger writing than those pill bottles show how he should take every single medication. She asks him about side effects and little things. How are you sleeping at night? What is this pain like? Is it on this scale or not? And that 15 minutes feels like an hour because of the intentionality that she gets to know my parents. And I sit there and I watch that. But why is this special and unique? You know, every physician should be a Heidi, and every person, particularly those who are most vulnerable, they need that level of attention. They deserve that. We all deserve that. So she's a gift, and you got me all choked up talking about Heidi. But it's her, and what she told me she did was like she stepped back from medical training and she got human in the moment. And my parents feel that, and they open up in ways, and they tell her stuff in ways that gives her so much information she can help them. Sometimes it's a pill. Most times it's an empathetic ear.
So in listening to her tell that story, we forget that she's managing director of the Ferguson Commission, and that in that role, she thinks about big picture systems and policy issues that touch racial and economic disparities in St. Louis.
But she also pointed out something that's easy to forget when you find yourself tangled in systemic structures, that systems are run by people, and the impact of how we treat and talk to one another can be just as important as policy.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Emmanuel Berry.
Shula Newman is our editor, and Margie Freivogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
Our theme music was produced by Cassie Morgan from St. Louis Public Radio. This is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.